Hello and welcome to the Maverick Radio Hour. I'm your host, Garrett Tufte, and it is January 5th, 2022, coming to you from Kansas City, Missouri, on this cold day out there. And it would appear that winter has finally hit. For those who were wondering about that during a lot of December there, it's quite warm, but it's pretty chilly now. And as usual, the swing back of these sorts of things, the weather has a tendency to do that, was eventually going to hit us at some point. So here we are. And I'd like to wish a happy new year to everyone out there, and also hope that y'all had some excellent holidays, considering the issues that we are nonetheless still working with and against and for. And so I hope y'all can look forward to a much better year than we had last year. Although at the same time, it would appear to me that what we had last year was a little bit better than the year before, since there was a fair amount of pushback against the again, the major thing that's happening today, once again, the giant elephant in the room that is important for us to mention rather than sidestep and ignore, because sidestepping and ignoring a major issue is the best way to make sure that it continues. And again, that elephant in the room is the virus panic and the astounding abuses that have been levied upon the people, not only of our country, but the rest of the world, through this fraud. And so last year there was a lot of pushback on this, and there was a whole lot of benefit when it came to general awareness about what's really going down and whether or not it was how dangerous the virus is and all these, and what sort of damage it can do to people, where it came from, all that sort of thing. A lot of that is secondary to the implementation of the, quote, measures to, quote, contain it, that when you look at that, what they call the Hegelian dialect is problem, reaction, solution, whereby the solution is ultimately the thing that the powers that be, quote, unquote, or those in authority, originally intended. So they create the excuse in order to bring in the what is basically an attack again on our country, the Constitution itself, that of individual liberty and our ability to choose and decide how we live our lives and what we do with them and what we do with our own bodies, of course. And this is huge, which when you look at the Bill of Rights, that's something that's conspicuously missing. And I can't blame the Founding Fathers. I don't think any of us really can. We can't really blame them for not seeing such a thing coming, because clearly when we're talking about individual liberties that need to be respected in order for government to have legitimacy, and you're talking about freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom to be secure in one's own properties as well. You look at the Fourth Amendment, such that they're not subject to arbitrary search and seizure. When you're talking about property, what you own, it's something that wasn't mentioned in the Bill of Rights directly was the fact that we have sovereignty over our own bodies. Now, it seems strange that I would imagine for them that this is, when we're talking about individual freedoms, that is something that would kind of go without saying, that if we have freedom of speech and we have freedom of the press, freedom of religious expression, and to worship what we wish, and also to be secure in our own property, like physical property, from arbitrary search and seizure without probable cause and warrant and that sort of thing, then it also stands to reason that we have control over our own bodies. And the whatever governing authority, whether it's some health authority, whether it's the federal government, state government, local government, whether it's your employer as an organization, so long as that employer, that organization is an American company that's incorporated here in the States, then for the most part it is subject to the restrictions that the Bill of Rights lays out explicitly. And so when it comes to, because right now what we're looking at is, and this is one of the things I was mentioning about 2021 that is good, is that we've had the legal pushback against these authoritarian mandates. And judges are stepping up, and it's awesome to see this, and it's incredibly important. And little by little, federal judges, state judges, all that sort of thing, the judicial branch is catching up. And of course it takes a little while for that to happen here, and it's a shame that it does, but nonetheless, now that it finally is, we're really seeing kind of the end to this. And you can see that what happened recently, or what was admitted by the president, that there is no, quote, federal solution to these mandates. And there never was, because no matter how you look at it, they're all completely illegal. And so, just judging by, even though we don't have explicitly a something in the Bill of Rights that says that you have bodily autonomy and Congress shall make no law that, you know, et cetera, in the same vein as those other laws, nonetheless, you can look at the Fourth Amendment and see that the sovereignty of which we have over our own bodies may be equated to the property that we are secure in having arbitrarily searched and seized. For us to be forced into a experimental medical treatment is of, it would appear to me, a level that would mean that our bodies are being seized by the state for whatever purpose they intend. And so if we look at it from that angle, from the Fourth Amendment angle, I think that's something that I think the Supreme Court is going to be looking at, and that might be certainly one of the ways in which they determine that these mandates are clearly illegal. So that's my that's at least one angle for that as it pertains to the Bill of Rights itself. And that would be in the case in the event that these mandates were actually law, as in we had the legislature came together and, you know, voted on it and said that this is a law, this is a policy, that sort of thing, and they put it as some sort of regulation for OSHA or et cetera. And they didn't even do that. I don't think anywhere even did that. Perhaps some local municipalities had a city council or a county had their commission that voted on such a thing and actually put it into words and laid it down as law. But that's in the event that it was actually law, then the judges could look at that and be like, well, this isn't legal. This law isn't legal, so, you know, it needs to be struck from the books, or it needs to be, you know, sent back to the legislature or some such thing. Because the presiding and superseding law is the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So even were these mandates law, they would still be illegal. Now, since they're not even law, and they weren't even voted on by a representative body, all they are just proclamations. They're just dictates. And you could just look at it as these people are just having, are sitting on their stage with their big megaphone, and they're just saying shit. That's it. Really, that's what it come down to. Certainly here in the States. In other countries, the exact details of how they've gone about this, it depends. Everywhere's been different, and there's been a different take on how they've implemented this or attempted to implement it and put it upon and enforce it upon the people. But in any of those cases, you can look at them as them either being simple proclamations, which anybody can do. I mean, I could go out on a hill myself and just proclaim, you know, X, Y, or Z, and say that you got to do this and you got to do that and you got to do this and that. But that doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm in a position of authority or not, whether I have a position of respect within the community or whether anybody does, for whether that person going out there and using their megaphone on a stage where everyone can see suddenly gives their proclamation weight that needs to be such that it needs to be followed by everyone. Really, it's the a lot of this has just been the groupthink. I mean, you lie to people enough, lie to enough of the population that they completely, totally believe this sort of thing. And then there's a groupthink pressure that presses upon and makes people think that, oh, well, yeah, everyone has to do this because they said that everyone has to do this, but they don't. It's quite unfortunate. And on that note, and to analyze this a little bit further and to examine it, as far as I had seen, this especially in 2020, the impositions brought on, and it would appear to me the real intention behind this, I laid out in a chart called The Tyranny Virus, Deconstruction of a Societal Weapon or the Great Unmasking. A couple weeks ago, the last podcast I put out, I went through a couple of these boxes and read a little bit from it and went on a bit of a tangent. But today, this is going to be a bit different because I would like to go through the entire thing and as well run through any tangents that crop up in the midst of it. Some, you know, side explanations for why it is I wrote this and, you know, that sort of deal. And some of my own, some of the other thoughts, you might call them annotations to the chart itself. But I went through a little bit of that last time, and to finish this thing out and also kind of seal the deal for 2021, I'd like to go through that a little bit further. So some of what I was reading before were the relevant, I read through before the relevant observations that I saw personally. These were the relative health of the homeless, the lack of patients at hotspot hospitals, the closing of public bathrooms, and the mass imposition of masks. These are the things that I saw and personally witnessed in March of 2020. And a lot of what I have here is are derivations or logical deductions as a result of the irrational acts that I witnessed. And another box here was timing. I went through that before. That was, I think, the last bit I actually read. There's another box here as context, and I'll just read that straight up. The interconnected and delicate nature of the global trade of nations and companies was building up to a necessary collapse of that system, i.e. the complexity and vital importance of the College of Corporations run by the immutable bylaws of business, the inconceivable enormity of such, in the mind of those who analyze policy and management of societies, could not conceive of adjusting or changing the direction of this massive beast, and that has been so instrumental for societal comforts, As such, in order to address systemic aggregations, negative byproducts of this system, pollution, poverty, population, psychosis, etc., it would appear that the high-level administrators opted to take a top-down, authoritative approach to these issues and abuse the people in the chosen manner. The, quote, gentle tyranny of the Chinese Communist Party is now in vogue under strategic pretext to maintain the world order. See The Limits of Growth by the Club of Rome for an early example of an analysis of global issues. Amongst the, quote, real politic crowd, this kind of social engineering is acceptable, as reprehensible as it is. I may have even tended to agree had I not discovered an infinitely better solution. See A New Economic. So, in the respect of in the context of large social aggregations, negative aggregations, what they call negative externalities as well, with the larger networks that we've made of international trade that of themselves are highly inefficient in being at a level that are sustainable. So this goes back to that that concept, globalist polluting with globalism, claim globalism the solution to pollution. And when you look at the fact that the international trade system that we've made is really can only really be a means to an end, ultimately, because that trade system relies upon utilizing non-renewable resources in order for its fuel and for its energy. So for us to get some plastic garbage from China has to come across on a giant barge across the ocean, halfway across the world, in order for it to get over to us and then get spread out and sent amongst the rest of the consumers here in the States. And in a similar manner, what we send them as trade for what they send us also goes across an ocean in order to get to them. And if we're talking about something here that can be easily made from available materials that are, you know, produced in that country, let's say, for instance, plastics, you have these plastics can be made wherever you have a plastics plant. So what do you need to make the plastics that you send out to the rest of the world? You basically need oil, you need some refining capability, and you need a factory and the machinery, people to run it, that sort of thing. So that can be done really in any industrialized nation. There's no need for there to be concentration of certain productive capabilities in one area of the world that thereby sends all of its products elsewhere in the world. That's that inefficiency of which I'm talking about. If you have smaller manufacturing hubs, smaller hubs of industry that do a similar thing, that is a much more efficient manner of creating these products and sending them out to the people who need them. This is a decentralized approach to providing the goods and the goods that people want and need. And this is one example of how that decentralization approach to really everything is beneficial for us. Because it reminds me of what they talked about when it came to the old Soviet Union. Part of the reason that it collapsed is that they would have cities that were dedicated to things like, okay, this city just worked on coal, this city just made steel, this city only did textiles, you know, that sort of thing. And on one level, it makes sense because you can centralize things like, okay, if we just have textiles here in this city, then the people who are in charge of that city and the workers are all dedicated to textiles and they're well trained to working on that sort of thing. And so we can have a very strong industry in this one place that makes this one thing. But when you have, if it's necessary for that, that place becomes so concentrated that it's the only place that makes a particular thing that everybody needs, well, what you end up with is that place, A, becomes too powerful for its own sort of benefit. So you end up having too much of a, how would you say, bargaining position, you might say. It's a monopoly, basically. It's an area that says, okay, you know, I can do whatever I want, and I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that, and if you don't give what I want, then I'm going to stop all exports of textiles to the rest of the country, or, you know, over whatever it is that's being made. And so the power that corrupts absolutely will lead to that sort of thing. And you will have petty tyrants who utilize the strength of their own private little fiefdom there in order to abuse the greater economy, if that makes sense. So that's there's a psychological aspect to that. That it would appear that this sort of thing played out during the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the fact that you just couldn't keep those sorts of things together, concentrating production of very important, you know, products and materials into specific areas that they themselves, the transportation system, this is the other next point on this, the transportation system is the spreading out of those products that are needed by everyone are dependent upon that transportation system. And so you could have a break in something of a supply that gives the energy for the trucks or the ships to send out this these products, and all of a sudden the benefit of having a centralized location where you focus on building a particular thing suddenly loses its benefit because there was a break in that supply chain. Whereas with a decentralized system, you don't have to worry so much about that sort of thing. If there was a plant here in every city that made basic hard plastics, like, let's just say, Tupperware, then the likelihood of people running out of Tupperware, not being able to store food well, is reduced down to, you know, negligible. But if there's only one place that makes it, and all the people that get it have to get it from that one place, well, let's say that there's a gas issue, or like we had over in South Carolina with the pipeline that ends up getting hacked, or any other, like here we had the winter weather that came on and then shut down an interstate over in Virginia. You know, having, if you have a plastics plant that makes that in, you know, each city, then if there's a problem or a bottleneck in one city, then the rest of the cities don't go without the product. You can still get it. And even to the level where, oh, well, you know, even send your horse and buggy down there to to pick up the stuff. But and so this is the benefit of a decentralized system, that it helps. It's helpful for the sustainability of the economy and the country and the people, such that whenever if there's a bottleneck or a problem somewhere where normally there would be like a problem of centralization issue, you don't have that. The other areas that have similar capabilities can simply step up their own production until the problem is resolved in the subject place. And so that is that's it's just a benefit across the board. And so the other thing about having a centralized area is the third thing, I suppose you might say, about having a centralized area that is just dedicated to sending out a particular thing, is that you have what could then be, this is related to the first point, where you have little people with petty fiefdoms who are attempting to abuse their position as monopolists would, and if they abuse that position, what you end up doing is capitulating to that sort of thing, and you end up giving away your rights, and you end up taking a bad deal when if the design of this went ahead prior, or you saw that the negatives involved with that centralization, you could prevent that eventuality or possibility from coming along. So, and again, you also have the fourth issue with that centralization is a loss of efficiency. So it's kind of like a cosine, a sine or cosine function, that there's an increase in efficiency as you centralize productive capabilities, until it gets to a point, and then it goes down, like the efficiency reduces the more you get to that centralization, the further you centralize. And that is a result of the simple, very real geography and distance and logistics that is required in order to send something from a centralized production facility out and spread out to the rest of the world. And so that centralization reaches a peak efficiency, and that peak efficiency is dependent upon quite literally the size of the Earth and how far outspread the population is that wants access to the product. So there's a balance there where efficiency is increases as you centralize production, but eventually it loses efficiency as that further centralization. So there's a balance there that's really good, and you could put together an algorithm of this sort of thing. There are equations you could find for this, and I would encourage those out there to do so. I mean, find the data here on efficiency of centralization, and then you can see that there's going to be data that shows that it levels off at some point. And about at that level is the sweet spot, you might say, where you get high efficiency and you get a certain amount of centralization, but you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You keep them spread out enough such that it's beneficial for the producer and the consumer and everyone else in between. So, and also concerning the context part, in order to address these, again, these are the negative externalities that come about as a result of this interconnected system that needed a way to be addressed. Because in so many manners, the continued usage, overusage of non-renewable resources amounts to running around on a merry-go-round that's eventually going to stop. And the ideal is that we utilize the resources that we have, we utilize energy that we do have, in order to create a sustainable and regenerative economy and way of life. That being such an important necessity for the continuation of our civilization, it thereby requires, in the minds of those who look at this sort of thing, it requires to do that would require drastic measures, if no other measures can be easily found. And since what we're witnessing with the virus panic is something that is clearly put together over decades, and the people involved with this, I don't think, I don't think you can just attribute it to a pure power motive. I think that at least some of the people involved here, and some of the planning involved here, probably some of it probably came from a want to fix this very issue. And so this is, I saw this myself long ago. If you look at that fact, and it's just all you have to really see, you don't even necessarily need to bring in global warming into the equation here. But if you just see the fact that the energy sources we use are non-renewable, and we can't just, you know, oil, so far as we know, isn't just regenerated in the center of the earth and then, you know, expelled out such that we can utilize it, and that there is a limit to it. That being the case, what you find out is the continued usage and excess usage that we have been, you know, using it in our society will end at some point. And if we don't mitigate that and have something to replace it, then we're going to end up with a very hard crash, and it's going to be pretty ugly. Now, this is the sort of thing that I saw years ago, and that led me to try to figure out an answer to this, which my answer to this was a new economic, and it still is. And that's what I mentioned there. I might have even tended to agree had I not discovered an infinitely better solution. So when you can change, you can utilize this, the new economic, in order to, all the benefit that I've gone through before. And it's a bit of, when this thing first came on back in March, I thought that the first thing that came to my mind was, oh man, I guess they, you know, they're trying to stop my idea here. Because really, folks, ideas are powerful, astoundingly powerful. You don't get to a level where you're altering the way that people live their lives and the way that governments operate until someone comes up with, like, let's say, the Republican system of government. Somebody way back when had to come up with it first. And now we're actually, you know, we're living with Republican forms of government. And we vote, and our representatives go, and they make the laws, and all of that. And we put them in positions of power. We don't necessarily live under kings and emperors and despots anymore. Because at some point there were some smart people around who said that, you know what, there's a better way we could do this. and this is how we do it. And they laid out the plan. Okay, you vote for this person and you vote for somebody, and then they make the rules and everyone else continues on with their lives. And if they do a bad job, then you vote someone else in after that, after a certain point, or you vote them back in. And so that's an idea. Somebody came up with that at some point. And it has led to much of the world utilizing that system. And so that's the power of an idea right there. Just one example of a thousand different ones. You look at the technology and what that has led to, the sorts of ideas that, you just look one after the other after the other. I mean, it's somebody that finds out that Freon can be utilized to create refrigeration, and what? Like, get out of here. You know, we don't need to import ice from the Arctic anymore in order to keep our food cool and for it to last longer. It's quite astounding what that can do. Rubber for tires, the wheel itself, I mean, fire, everything. So really, one of the most powerful things in this world, in our plane of existence, are ideas. And it took me 15 years to figure out a new economic and figure some manner in which to that we can revolutionize our economic system in a manner that can benefit as many people as possible, fix as many problems, societal problems as possible, and at the same time have an equitable and lawful manner of doing that. Because this thing, New Economic, again, I didn't put this in the flyer, but I don't know why I didn't. This should go in there. Is that it's 100% constitutional. It's entirely lawful to do this. It just requires Congress, it requires the Treasury Department, it requires at the federal level a convention of states in a similar manner to putting in a new amendment to the Constitution. I think that would be fair. And when I put this out there, I figured that, oh, okay, I'm probably going to be arguing for this for years and years and years and years until it finally goes through. Nonetheless, that's what I was doing. And I didn't expect that it would necessarily, oh, all of a sudden everyone wants to do it, and all of a sudden we're doing it, and it's happening, and that sort of thing. Because clearly, in order to have something like this, in order to make it happen, it requires a lot of preemptive work, and an army of accountants, and a lot of changes to infrastructure and supply chains and everything else. And so it's not something you do overnight. And I didn't expect it would be. And I thought that I would be arguing for this for years and years and years. And here I am, you know, it's a couple years now. and I'm still arguing for it. Now, this might go on for a while. That's okay, you know. But it takes a while for these sorts of things to go forward. And all the same, the fact that it is a revolutionary idea that will and would do exactly what I say here on the front page of the pamphlet, recreate the American Empire, liberate the people, the U.S. and the world, preempt economic collapse, drastically reduce energy consumption, free the human spirit, create the greatest society in written history. Maybe that's a little... maybe I'm pushing a little far on that one, but lead the world into the 21st century. I mean, it really will do all that. It really would. And so it as a, just as an idea and the power that comes with that sort of thing. I thought that this thing coming along would be like the first thing that came to my mind is, oh, they're trying to stop this idea. And if you look at the measures that were actually introduced, you would notice that especially the mass imposition of masks, what this does is to stop people from talking to each other. Forced isolation and house arrest stop people from talking to each other and stop meeting. curfews so that you can't go out to the bar and talk with folks. Stop people getting together and talking and meeting. You know, stop people from exchanging ideas and discussing, because that's what all of this does. All of the measures imposed upon the people stops folks from talking to each other and from us from communicating. And it's clear, and that of its own, if you look at this from the perspective of a, you know, would-be rulers who treat us like peasants and serfs, that's the sort of thing that they would do. And if they saw this idea as something that was a threat to their continued authority, which it is, imposing measures that stop people from talking to each other and communicating and quite possibly talking about this idea and spreading it around, you can see how that would be justified. Or they would justify that in their minds by doing so. At the same time, the overall imposition of this is more than that. Again, it's clear that it's been in the makings for decades. So it as the end, it being the, you know, quote, final solution to the fossil fuel overuse and to the global warming issue and to, you know, what people claim is an excessive population, it appears to me the sort of thing that is an end to that. Now it just so happens that one of the side effects that this has is to stop people from talking to each other and to basically ruin and destroy the human spirit and the progress of science and the progress of social ideas, progress of society in general, the growth of individuals. I mean, all of this, all the measures of isolation and criminalizing speech and criminalizing just living your life are, I mean, the end result is a dystopia, a hellscape for the individual. And maybe it's beneficial for a couple of tin pot dictators, but for everyone else, it's not helpful at all. It's not beneficial. It's not an enjoyable way to live. But nonetheless, they brought it on. And in my mind at the time, pushing forth with my idea, it seemed like, okay, well, that this thing, with the shutdown of communication, is an attempt to stop the spreading of a new economic as an idea. Now, that's a little bit of ego there, but at the same time, we have to understand that ideas really are powerful, and when they are fresh and they are new, and that they would do exactly what it says on here, and these are all great things, then you have to understand that those who have access to so many resources and people are aware of that as well, and to stop new ideas is certainly something that's going on with this tyranny virus too. And on that note, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.